Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, a non-profit scientific organisation also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. Last month during July, we held ISAP's annual scientific meeting in Banff, Canada, bringing together scientists from 24 countries for discussion and learning on the science of biotics. Our previous podcast episode shared some highlights from four of our plenary speakers, and this episode shares some of the excellent work presented during the meeting's poster session. The four presenters featured in this podcast are all members of ISAP's Students and Fellows Association and received the highest overall scores this year from our panel of poster judges. We hope you enjoy these poster highlights from the 2025 ISAP annual meeting. Our first highlighted poster is presented by Benjamin Levine from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the USA. He describes a randomized crossover clinical trial investigating the effects of whole grain foods on intestinal motility and postprandial nutrient metabolism, utilizing readouts from ingestible capsules and other endpoints. Here's Benjamin with an overview of his work.
My name is Benjamin Levine, and I'm a PhD student in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Our lab investigates how diet-microbe interactions shape host responses related to intestinal motility, psychological stress, and metabolism. And to investigate these topics, it's important to recognize that both human and food that we consume are remarkably complex. The food that we consume contains a diverse array of nutrients, but its structure, known as the food matrix, can influence how food and its nutrients are digested and absorbed, and these processes can depend on the unique physiology of the host. And when we consider the interactions between these two complex biological systems, the host and the nutrients that it consumes, it becomes evident that a one-size-fits-all approach, or simply looking at the mean response to a given exposure, may not be as informative as once thought. And in nutrition, one of the methods for characterizing a host response to a meal is by measuring changes in postprandial metabolism, such as excursions in blood glucose. And these responses are important for understanding and managing conditions associated with dysregulated nutrient metabolism, such as type 2 diabetes, or conditions associated with uncoordinated intestinal motility, such as irritable bowel syndrome or IBS. And although these conditions may appear unrelated, comorbidity is evident as individuals with IBS are twice as likely to have metabolic syndrome compared to adults without IBS. And this comorbidity details the importance of understanding variability in dietary responses. So a central question in nutrition over the past decade has been why individuals, even identical twins consuming identical meals, can exhibit markedly different responses to a meal. This variability can be better understood by considering factors such as genetics, gut microbiome composition, dietary patterns, sex, age, and physical activity, which together can help predict an individual's response to a meal. So we hypothesized that individual intestinal motility responses could be an underappreciated determinant in this variability because it's the physiological parameter that couples the digestion absorption of nutrients to the postprandial appearance of those nutrients in the bloodstream. So to test this idea, we conducted a randomized crossover trial where we recruited 34 participants with equal numbers of males and females who each participated in two separate sessions spaced about 1 week apart. At each session, they consumed one of two homemade breads, either a whole grain pumpernickel rye bread, which is rich in prebiotic fructans, or a refined grain bread, which has negligible amounts of these prebiotics in them. Along with the bread, participants swallowed a smart pill, which is an ingestible biomedical device that's able to capture high-resolution data on the luminal environment, including transient changes in pH, pressure, and temperature every few seconds as it moves throughout the intestinal tract. And this allows us to pinpoint when the smart pill and the bread is in the stomach, the small intestine, or the colon, so we can characterize segmental and whole gut transit times and contractions. We also sampled blood to see in real time if patterns of intestinal motility can mediate postprandial metabolic responses. So some of the preliminary data suggest that intestinal motility and postprandial responses were sexually dimorphic. For instance, women tended to have fewer stomach contractions and longer gastric emptying times compared to men, which were paired with broader and later rises in blood glucose.
Whole gut transit time varied widely from as short as 10 hours to as long as 56 hours across participants, where women had longer whole gut transit times compared to men. And most of this variability came from differences in colonic motility, where women tended to have longer colonic transit times, less powerful colonic contractions, and fewer colonic contractions compared to men. However, this effect only appeared in females who consumed the whole grain prebiotic-rich bread. This was interesting to us because this work was inspired in part by our preclinical trials, where we demonstrated that feeding the same prebiotics in the whole grain bread to mice enhanced the abundance of microbes that synthesize the neurotransmitter GABA. And GABA-producing microbes such as Bifidobacterium, Bacteroides, Akkermansia, and Lactobacillus have been demonstrated to confer inhibitory activity in the enteric nervous system because GABA can coordinate intestinal motility contractions, leading to less powerful colonic contractions specifically. We demonstrated using an ex vivo colonic motility assay that only female mice were responsive to GABA at doses that reflect what's seen in the lumen after a prebiotic-rich diet. So the parallels between these preclinical findings and what we observed in humans makes us especially excited about the potential of using targeted prebiotic fibers to leverage microbial metabolism and regulate post-intestinal motility and postprandial responses.
Thank you, Benjamin. That's really interesting work revealing the potential interactions of diet and sex and the relationship between motility and metabolic responses. Thank you for your time. The next poster we'd like to highlight is presented by Carolyn Druko from the University of Antwerp, Belgium. Carolyn presented work at the ISAT meeting from the ASALA Citizen Science Project, exploring the vaginal microbiome's metabolic landscape. Here's Carolyn describing the findings.
So my name is Caroline Druko. I'm a PhD student at the University of Antwerp in Belgium, and I study the role of B vitamins in the vaginal microbiome. So a few years ago, my host lab, the group of Professor Sarah Lebeer at the University of Antwerp, launched the ISALA project. And this project was a large citizen science project where more than 3,000 women across Belgium donated vaginal swabs so we could study the vaginal microbiome. The goal of this project was to better understand the composition and the function of lactobacilli, which are key to vaginal health. And to do this, we combined different techniques, including metabolomics, metagenomics, and culturomics. In other words, we studied who was present, what they could produce, and then we also tried to isolate them in the lab. Now, the story that I want to share with you today, so the one that was on my poster about riboflavin, actually started with a lucky accident. In our collection of isolates, we found a Limose Lactobacillus reuteri strain that was unusually fluorescent. A bright green fluorescence. And it turned out that this strain was overproducing riboflavin or vitamin B2. From the very same participant, we isolated over other strains that looked almost identical genetically, but they produced much less riboflavin. So by chance, we actually obtained a natural overexpressing mutant and then a wild-type strain, we can say. So it was almost like a building experiment in that same swap. So that's perfect to study the biological impact of vitamin B2 production. And then when we zoomed out, so when we looked at the larger ISALA datasets, we realized that riboflavin production wasn't just an oddity of these few strains. Based on the in silico searches and in vitro validation in the lab, we found that it was actually quite common amongst vaginal lactobacilli, especially in those species strongly associated with vaginal health, like Lactobacillus crispatus, Jensenii, and then also Limose Lactobacillus species. And then also in our mesobaldomics dataset, we saw that riboflavin was actually the most clearly linked with Lactobacillus crispatus. And then, of course, the big question became, why do these lactobacilli produce riboflavin in the vagina? And there are a few reasons that make sense here. So first of all, riboflavin is an essential cofactor in many biochemical reactions. So making it locally might help both microbes and host cells to thrive. Second, riboflavin is known as an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory compound, and this could help keep the environment balanced. And then third, and for me the most fascinating, is that riboflavin precursors and some derivatives of them can activate a specific type of T cells called mucosal-associated invariant T cells or MAIT cells. And from previous gut and respiratory research, we already know that these mast cells can help protect epithelial barriers. Most importantly, they can actually activate, or they can be activated by bacteria in a way that promotes tolerance rather than inflammation. So if vaginal lactobacilli really do this through riboflavin production, it means that there is an additional evidence that they are not just passively present, but they're actually actively helping to regulate the immune balance. So what I've been investigating most recently using vaginal epithelial 3D models is this mast cell activation. And we saw that not only mast cells become activated, but they also do it in a way that's different from vaginal pathobionts, including, for example, Candida. So while this research is still ongoing, our data is starting to suggest that, yes, riboflavin could be a key link between beneficial lactobacilli and host health through this mast cell axis.
Thank you, Caroline. That's fascinating to learn about the potential role of vitamin production by lactobacilli in the maintenance of vaginal health. Congratulations to both Benjamin and Caroline for being recipients of this year's poster awards at the ISAP meeting. Another excellent poster at the meeting was presented by Salem Simon of University College Cork and APC Microbiome Ireland. Her poster featured work using bacteriophage-derived endolysins to target Clostridioides difficile. Let's hear from Salem about this study.
My name is Salem Simon. I'm a PhD candidate at APC Microbiome Ireland, affiliated with University College Cork, and under the supervision of Professors Colin Hill and Paul Ross. I presented a poster at ISAP titled Targeted Microbiome Editing Using a Novel Bacteriophage-Derived Endolysin with Lytic Activity Against C. difficile. For those who may be unfamiliar, endolysins are bacteriophage-derived hydrolases that degrade the peptidoglycan layer in bacterial cell walls. They ultimately lead to cell lysis. And so endolysins are those key players for phages at the end of the lytic phage life cycle, once novel viral progeny are produced and need to escape their bacterial hosts. Endolysins are produced at this stage and gain access to the peptidoglycan layer to allow for this release to happen. My work is focused on developing endolysins as antimicrobials against C. difficile and MRSA. And endolysins are promising antimicrobials for these pathogens in particular, as they are gram-positive bacteria with a peptidoglycan layer that's exposed to the external environment. So in the work that I presented at ISAP, we started with phage genome analysis and identified an endolysin gene, we'll call it CWH2, in the genome of a phage targeting C. difficile. We had the gene synthesized for expression in E. coli, and used recombinant engineering to introduce the gene into a PET plasmid, followed by transformation into E. coli BL21 cells. After this, we were able to induce CWH2 gene expression with IPTG and purify the protein with HIS-TEG affinity chromatography. Once we had the purified protein, we performed a number of different structural and biochemical characterization tests. Firstly, we did in silico analysis and found that CWH2 is around 30 kilodaltons in size with two main domains. There's a catalytic amidase domain at the N-terminal and a putative cell wall binding domain at the C-terminal. And it's believed that the cell wall binding domain will bind to the peptidoglycan and aid the catalytic domain in drawing it closer to its site of action. We also sent some of the purified protein to IQF, CSIC in Madrid, and I was also able and lucky enough to go there on a research exchange where we worked with our amazing collaborators, Professor Juan Hermoso and my colleague Sara Aikin, who specialize in X-ray crystallography. There, we tried to determine the actual structural identity of CWH2, although this work is still ongoing. Back in Ireland, we did some biochemical characterization work to find the optimal conditions to source CWH2, and we also assessed its stability. In these tests, we found that the endolysin is pretty happy in minimal conditions. It's best maintained in TRIS-HCl at pH 8 and retains optimal lytic activity when treated in up to 55 degrees Celsius or 131 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 hour. And when I say retain optimal lytic activity, I mean the ability to reduce the turbidity of inactivated C. difficile cultures by at least 50%. We also looked at the host range of CWH2. And we evaluated this by way of spot assays against multiple Clostridioides species, non-Clostridioides species, and a variety of commensal intestinal bacteria. Here, we found that CWH2 has a pretty narrow host range, confined to mainly Clostridioides species. And again, this is really important in that these hydrolases are able to target their specific bacteria without affecting commensals in the local environment. This is, of course, in contrast to broad-spectrum antibiotics that are typically used to treat C. difficile. Lastly, we performed some preliminary lytic activity work with CWH2 and found that the endolysin can reduce C. difficile cultures over one log in only 2 hours and decrease the optical density of cultures by nearly 60% in 1 hour. Overall, we are very excited by the initial results from this work. CWH2 appears to be a promising antimicrobial to be used against C. difficile, and we're looking forward to future and ongoing experiments to assess this endolysin in more complex microbial communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ceylon. That's great to hear about the potential of the phage-derived antimicrobials for more specific approaches to combating disease-causing bacteria. Thank you for sharing your work. Our final researcher in this episode, also with one of the top-ranked posters, is Qinong Yang from the University of Michigan in the USA. The work he presented at the ISAT meeting delves into the interplay between dietary fiber and mesin-degrading bacteria in the host gut, with a focus on inflammatory bowel disease development.
I'm Qinong Yang. I'm a postdoc working at the University of Michigan with Dr. Eric Martens. Our lab interested in how bacteria utilizing different dietary sources in the gut. For me personally, specifically, I'm interested in how bacteria can utilize the mucus in the gut and how this could interact in the IBD context. As we know, IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, is a serious health burden in developed country. And nowadays, it is also becoming more and more common in developing countries as well. And there's mounting evidence have shown that an unbalanced diet plays an important, and if not the most important, role in causing the disease. Previously, our group showed that when lacking dietary fiber, the mucus-degrading bacteria in the gut will expand and starting to degrade more holes the mucus layer. The mucus layer, as we know, it served as a defensive mechanism in the gut. And that means that if we don't eat enough fiber, the gut bacteria would eat the host mucus, so eat the host. And despite its broad prevalence, the exact cause of IBD is still remain unknown. Our group believe that the diet lack dietary fiber could in part contribute the disease, especially for people that are already genetically predisposed to IBD. To study the diet and microbial interaction in the context of IBD, we used a synthetic microbial community that contained 14 bacterial species. We colonized the community into germ-free IL-10 knockout mice. These IL-10 knockout mice were chosen because they have genetic predisposition to IBD. What we found out was that these mice were given a fiber-free diet. The mucus-degrading bacteria increases their abundances. These mice then got sick and died early, while the mice on fiber-rich diet, they were just okay. We did a follow-up experiment without the four mucus-degrading bacteria in the community and gave these mice fiber-free diet. All these mice were just doing okay, even on the fiber-free diet. So mucus-degrading bacteria seems to play a really important role in our model, and we want to figure out who is playing a key role in causing inflammation in the model. In our community, we have four mucus-degrading bacteria. So to study who's playing a key role, we used a reductionist approach, where I dropped out each mucus-degrading bacteria in sequence. I start with dropping the lowest abundant mucus-degrading bacteria, and the disease outcome remains the same, becomes more interestingly when two mucus-degrading bacteria were dropped out, where when there's a mucus-degrading bacterides that coexist with mucus-degrading Archimantia, the mice got sick, especially with the combination of bacterides theta oda omicrons, in short B theta, and archimansia, the disease outcome are just like the one in the full community. So we hypothesize that archimansia and B-theta are causing the inflammation in our model, and to rule out the potential role of other non-mucus degrading bacteria in the background community, we bicolonize germ-free mice with only archimansia and B-theta, and give these mice either a fiber-rich diet or a fiber-free diet. And the one on fiber-rich diet survived just fine through 150 days, while the one on fiber-free diet, the mice all died before day 60. So we're seeing this whopping differences in survival just because of change of diet. So we also want to know why B-theta and archimansia seems to be working together to cause disease in mice. And it turns out archimansia can only use intact mucus, while B-theta can only use released mucin sugar from mucus. And what's more interestingly, using a co-culture system, we demonstrated that B-theta could actually use the released mucus product by archimansia. We then conclude that this cross-feeding between archimansia and B-theta really contributed to the accelerated disease outcome in our model. So our work demonstrated the interaction between diet, mucus-degrading bacteria in the context of IBD. So it could and also provide interesting insight in how to prevent IBD by switching diet.
Thank you, Chinan, for sharing this work. There's some intriguing microbial and dietary interactions there, potentially playing a role in IBD development. To all of our poster presenters, a sincere thank you for sharing your work at our annual meeting and with our ISAP community here on this podcast.